KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. New Mexico Congresswoman Yvette Herold's objection to the certification of Arizona and Pennsylvania electoral votes has been unanimously condemned by the Las Cruces City Council. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
City Councilor Ioana Bencomo was just one of the vocal members on the Las Cruces City Council who voiced disdain for Representative Yvette Herold's opposition to certifying electoral votes in Arizona and Pennsylvania.
I think it's important for us to have this conversation because Representative Yvette Herold represents all of us. And just like I expect to be held to high standards and be held accountable for the things I do and say and my votes, I get emails all the time about people disagreeing with me, and I appreciate that. And so for me, as this body who I know respects the sacredness of democracy and the vote, I think this is an important public statement. We can disagree on policies, but this is not that. Disenfranchising voters is not a for argument on a policy issue.
Prior to the certification of the 2020 presidential election, Representative Herold addressed her opposition during House debate.
The Constitution gives state legislators, not state executives or judges, the sole authority to determine how their state selects presidential electors. Nobody disputes that in Pennsylvania, as well as in other states, rules and regulations were changed by executive fiat or judicial edict. These changes were significant and irregular. They included changes to vote-by-mail deadlines, identity verification requirements, and other ballot handling practices.
Originally, Councilor Yvonne Flores indicated she would not support the resolution, but was moved by the words of Councilor Tessa Abeda-Stuvey, who spoke about how election fraud claims have been dismissed in courts across America.
Our foundations of relationship with our neighbors, our friends, our family, or even with elected officials must be based on transparency and truth. And that, to me, is a neutral and nonpartisan issue. Judicial review process also helps with that, and that is why we have the separation of powers. With this election, there were many, many claims, many lawsuits, many reviews of that process, all that found that this was a fair and legal election.
The marginalization of voters was of large concern to Councilor Bencomo, who says minority voters were the ones most at risk of being disenfranchised.
The issue of racial equity. The votes of Arizona and Pennsylvania, there was so much work done by Black, Brown, and Indigenous organizations who turned out in record numbers in those states, in Arizona and Pennsylvania. So by voting to not support the certification of those votes cast out of that state is inherently disenfranchising the voters of those states, which predominantly and in huge numbers were Black, Brown, and Indigenous voters.
Mayor Ken Miyagashima advocated for an amendment, which later passed, stating Herold failed to support, defend, and protect the U.S. Constitution. He emphasized his vote was not a partisan one, rather a need to defend the Constitution.
We both took this oath, Representative, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. You know, when you voted against it, I don't think you did. I don't think you did preserve. I don't think you did protect it, and I don't think you defended the Constitution. If I don't vote for this, and I'm not defending it either.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
In addition to her refusal to certify election results, Herold has also been criticized for her vote against the second impeachment of Donald Trump. Well, many groups are very upset about this, including Common Cause New Mexico. KUNM's Khalil Eculona spoke with the executive director of the nonpartisan voter protection nonprofit, Heather Ferguson. She's calling for Herold to resign.
This was the most free and fair election that we have had in our nation's history. It was the most secure that's been verified not only by our National Secretaries of State's President, Maggie Toulouse-Oliver, here from New Mexico, from the national cybersecurity folks, to all the members of Congress from across the board, with the exception of these individuals who continue to want to try to make a call out to challenge electoral votes that were rightfully done. And in doing so, she continues to fan the flames of insurrection. She's violating her oath of office by challenging these electoral votes. and we need her to resign.
You all have also called for the resignation of Otero County Commissioner Coy Griffin. Is that for similar reasons?
Actually, it's because County Commissioner Griffin has gone a step farther and attended and was a participant in those riots and in the insurrection that we saw so violently acted at our nation's capital last week. He was talking about ensuring that they would have a second gathering or storming of the Capitol on January 20th, where, and this was his quote, blood will run from the building. And that is inexcusable from an elected official, and that should be something that he should be criminally charged for, to threaten the House Speaker and our Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer.
Now, that's interesting, because you mentioned that he should be legally and criminally charged for his incendiary comments. And you know, I'm watching the national news now, and a lot of these lawmakers who have expressed misinformation, disinformation, and have made a lot of inflammatory comments are expressing that it is their First Amendment right to do so. How does that hit you?
I am a very staunch advocate for the First Amendment, but there is no realm where you can issue death threats and incite violence and have that be something that is covered by the First Amendment. We have an elected official with a platform to reach members of the public who is trying to encourage his followers to attack and hurt and harm and kill other elected officials. I have no idea why this man is possibly still allowed to maintain his public office right now.
What are some ways that people can talk to each other so we can all understand each other and come to actual conversation that we can agree on upon things that are called facts?
The number one issue that we always point people to, especially when it comes from ensuring that not only are you not being misinformed by individuals that you may trust, but also making sure that you're not exposing yourself to misinformation that is just out there. And it's really considering your source and trying to look for where are the actual facts in here. And you don't get to just make up facts if you don't get what you want.
What do you see for our political landscape if we have two sides that are so opposed in just the functions of government outside of any political philosophy? Any predictions of where we go from here?
What has been the most saddening side of the work that I've done with Common Cause in the last 6 years is seeing how much more tribalistic partisan politics has become. And I think that it is even more saddening that they have to close our state capitol simply to protect our elected officials. I think that that is not what America stands for. That's not what New Mexico certainly stands for. And so my hope would be, with some time, and I think it is going to take some time, that these partisan fires that keep happening, these fights, will begin to start to dissipate. We're a country in crisis, and we're a state in crisis, and it needs to be treated as such. Everyone needs to try to find a way to come together, and if they have already created some insurrection, they've already participated in a lot of this, they need to own that what they did was wrong, and they need to move away from that.
She is Heather Ferguson. She is the Executive Director for Common Cause New Mexico. Heather, thanks again.
Thanks so much, Khalil.
Meantime, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton's failed lawsuit seeking to throw out election results in other states came originally from lawyers close to the campaign of former President Donald Trump. As KERA's Brett Jaspers reports, the new details were revealed this week by the New York Times.
The Times reports lawyers allied with Trump drafted the lawsuit, but needed a state attorney general to officially bring it. That's because only a state AG can sue another state and have the case go straight to the U.S. Supreme Court. The team lobbied Louisiana Attorney General Jeff Landry to take the lead because Paxton had been tainted by recent corruption allegations, but Landry declined and Paxton took it up, despite protests from lawyers on his staff. The Texas Solicitor General Kyle Hawkins reportedly wouldn't let his name be used on the suit. Hawkins announced in mid-January plans to resign from the state attorney general's office. In a news release, the AG's office said Hawkins' last day would be February 1st. Paxton declined to comment to the Times. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
Paxton's office did not reply to a request from KERA seeking comments. Texas voters are asking for more transparency and less political influence on how electoral boundaries are drawn. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports on a recent state Senate hearing on redistricting.
Some people ask that lawmakers remove politics entirely from the process by making Texas the 15th state in the country to leave redistricting up to nonpartisan commissions. That's unlikely to happen, though. Others simply ask that lawmakers draw maps that don't split up communities into different political districts and draw boundaries that take into account population growth among communities of color. Marla Lopez from Houston told lawmakers that would include creating districts for the state's fast-growing Asian and Latino communities.
Our communities are growing, and we need to be represented fairly. We cannot afford to have our voices diluted.
Some voters are asking that lawmakers continue to hold virtual public input hearings after maps are proposed. Redistricting relies heavily on census data that is not expected to be released to states until later this spring, which means Texas lawmakers will likely be forced to take this up during a special session. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
New Mexico is also considering a redistricting commission. We'll be following that and much more as the legislative session continues. Meantime, New Mexico lawmakers from both sides of the aisle are voicing concerns about President Joe Biden's pause on oil, saying recent actions by the Biden administration will undoubtedly have long-term implications for the state's financial outlook. President Biden has put a temporary pause on new oil and gas leases on federal lands. Industry groups and state regulators testified this week before a key Senate committee about potential production decreases and revenue losses. New Mexico has already seen a decrease in drilling rigs and decisions by developers to shift multi-million dollar investments elsewhere, with oil and gas revenues accounting for a significant portion of New Mexico's budget. Experts warned lost revenue will have to be made up through spending cuts or tax increases. Well, we're talking with local state legislators from our listening area during the legislative session. This week, Anthony Moreno talked with District 35 Democratic State Representative Angelica Rubio of Las Cruces, who discussed paid sick leave legislation she's working on.
Representative Rubio, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks, Anthony.
Now, I'd like to start off talking about paid sick leave in New Mexico. Let's start off by talking about this bill that you're sponsoring. What we know of paid sick leave is at least 13 states in the country and Washington, D.C. have a paid sick leave policy in place. I want to hear about how the pandemic may be impacting the chances of this bill. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, thanks, Anthony. New Mexico for the first time is going to be considering paid sick leave here in the state of New Mexico. For us, it's a really straightforward piece of legislation. It's House Bill 37. For folks who are listening, paid sick leave isn't additional benefits. It is just, that's why we call it earned paid sick leave, because a person has worked the time to be able to take the time off. But right now, with the way that COVID has impacted essential workers, especially, a lot of folks have had to choose between a paycheck and staying home and staying safe. And so this bill is not only legislation and policy that we've been trying to work through local communities for several years now, but we feel because of the height of COVID and what we've experienced so far, that this is the best time to get it done.
Now, obviously there's some challenges. There's been communities across the state that have tried similar pieces of legislation, but they haven't been able to get it passed. At the statewide level, there may be some challenges from the business community. Some corporations may be able to handle this, but what about the small business owner who is already struggling to get through the pandemic? How do you plan to help that business owner be able to implement a plan like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really great question. And unfortunately, what's happened over the course of the last few years, and you've seen it here locally, is that you've had small businesses being pitted against workers and vice versa, except that what this legislation does and a lot of different other pieces of legislation are trying to do in the legislature is address both. And I think when we're talking about paid sick leave and earning paid sick leave, This isn't something extra that the small businesses will have to provide. This is, like I mentioned, this isn't an added benefit. These are hours that a worker has earned to be able to take off. And so when we're talking about how small businesses will be impacted, it's important for folks to understand that the chances of the success of a small business is based on the health of their employees. And this is why the paid sick leave bill is so important. We are, of course, going to have that debate in committee tomorrow, as well as this bill progresses. But I think this bill is one of many that are being addressed in the legislature to not only support and impact workers, but also really help to infuse and stimulate the small business economy throughout the state of New Mexico.
So is there anything that you think the state could possibly do to help out some of these small businesses who may be wanting to get on board with this, but you know, when it comes down to the bottom line, they just don't have the funds to make it happen?
Yeah, so the state right now, within the state legislature, there are a number of issues that are being considered by other legislators that will impact small businesses outside of just this legislation. I think what is important for this paid sick leave bill is that this bill doesn't solve all of our issues, and it shouldn't. It should be much more comprehensive and robust. And there are a number of other pieces of legislation that go hand in hand with this piece of legislation that will not only just address the workers' piece, which is what we're trying to do, but also other pieces of legislation that will work towards supporting small businesses in the long run, especially as we think about recovery.
Now, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but do you feel that the momentum due to the pandemic may actually change some minds on this piece of legislation in regards to offering paid sick leave in New Mexico?
I mean, I'm being optimistic about it. There are two paid sick leave bills. One is House Bill 20, which is being led by Representative Christine Chandler and Damon Eli. And then, of course, this one, which is House Bill 37. Both bills have very little differences, but both myself and the other sponsors, we are determined that New Mexico will have a paid sick leave bill sent to the governor's office at the end of this session.
Angelica Rubio, she is a state representative for District 35 in New Mexico. I want to thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks, Anthony.
You can watch that entire conversation on the Your Legislators page. You'll find it in the local TV section at krwg.org. The New Mexico Civil Rights Commission was authorized through March to examine a number of issues, including qualified immunity. That's the legal principle that usually grants government officials immunity from civil suits when they make many decisions. The commission voted 5-4 to eliminate qualified immunity protections for government agencies, but unanimously upheld protections for individual employees. KRWG News talked with the local members of the commission, Doñana County District Attorney Gerald Byers and County Sheriff Kim Stewart.
First, qualified immunity truly is a judicial construct. It is a court-by-court decision, case-by-case. So the thought that qualified immunity would immediately and forever absolve someone, for instance, in law enforcement from any kind of litigation is erroneous. So nationally, there is no database to actually determine how many cases or how many instances is someone excused from qualified immunity. Also, qualified immunity actually covers a number of professions, teachers, CYFD, social workers, nurses who work for the state. There are a number of professions that would be impacted if we got rid of qualified immunity. The other thing is that the commission voted to get rid of qualified immunity 5-4, with me being a dissenter as well, and yet voted 9-0 to indemnify us. So as long as we're within the scope of policy and or the law, we're covered anyway. So I found that juxtaposition very interesting, to say the least. So I'm against getting rid of qualified immunity in far-sweeping legislation like this. Perhaps on a more specific, directed focus, it's something to look at. It's just in this venue, it is not appropriate.
Okay. Gerald, your thoughts on this. Same idea, your thoughts on qualified immunity.
I echo Sheriff Stewart's position and would just have a few points to offer. Because on the one hand, qualified immunity, it's a buffer between the government and the government actors and people who are civilly trying to redress a wrong. But the thing is that it that prevents a chilling effect, because if a law enforcement officer or other government actor were totally exposed to severe financial penalty just for an act that arose out of them doing their job, that would really chill the desire of people to be public servants. However, one of the things that it's totally true what Sheriff Stewart mentioned, when it came to the point of voting on whether or not qualified immunity should be supported, interestingly, all of the members of the Civil Rights Commission decided, hold on now, we will not vote to impose this penalty on the individual bad actor, in complete juxtaposition to what the bill had been advertised as being, to hold the bad actor law enforcement officer accountable. And I'll just interject and say that I've spoken with a number of law enforcement officers since this Civil Rights Commission commenced. And I can tell you that there are many, many law enforcement officers who want only the best officers in their ranks. They want only supreme, experienced professionals who are totally committed to serving the public. And they have no tolerance for those folks who just barely skate by or skirt the rules or are abusive to people. And so this is a work in progress, but I think it's a good start, but we should, improvement is required.
That was Doñana County District Attorney Gerald Byers, and before that, County Sheriff Kim Stewart. They are the local members of the New Mexico Civil Rights Commission. You can watch our entire conversation tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV's Newsmakers. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says small, fast loans often lead to a cycle of ever-deepening debt. Lawmakers in New Mexico are considering whether to further regulate the industry. Senate Bill 66 would cap the rates and fees so that they are in line with national averages. KUNM's Khalil Aquilona caught up with the Santa Fe reporter's Jeff Proctor to talk about the effort.
Essentially, what we're talking about here are what folks used to think of as payday loans and title loans. In other words, you could walk into a storefront with a pay stub or the title to your vehicle and get a loan at an incredibly high interest rate because you needed cash right now. Mm-hmm. So that has existed in New Mexico for decades and decades. The industry often refers to these as installment loans. You pay them back in installments and the interest compounds over time. The situation we're in now is that payday loans really don't exist in New Mexico anymore, but these small dollar installment loans do. There has been a long history of a lack of regulatory framework for this industry in New Mexico. We used to have what was called a usury statute in the state, which set caps on all different types of loans. And when I say caps, I mean above a certain interest rate, you weren't allowed to charge.
Okay.
So that cap went away some decades ago. That's problematic in a place like this because, of course, we deal with issues of lack of access to the American dream and generational poverty. So anyway, fast forward to the late kind of 2000s, there began to be an effort among some legislators and the Attorney General at the time, Gary King, to start regulating this industry. There had been all kinds of horror stories. It essentially went nowhere as the industry, which of course makes tons of money, paid a bunch of lobbyists and showered campaign cash all over both sides of the aisle. In 2017, the legislature passed what it called a compromise that did cap the interest rate annually at 175%.
Now, you know, we're in the midst of COVID, which has devastating effects on the economy. Does that increase the likelihood of the legislation passing of capping it at 35-36%?
Some legislators feel a sense of urgency now, given the economic devastation that the coronavirus pandemic has wrought. And just quickly, in case we didn't put a fine enough point on it for listeners, there is a bill that's been pre-filed that would cap the rate at 36%. There's an important distinction with this year's bill. It's not just the interest rate that could be a maximum of 36% for the year. It also includes all of the fees, and it's an all-in 36%. And then the other bit of sort of hope comes from the little bit of landscape shift that we've seen in the legislature. Previously, we've seen some blockage of reform efforts in this sector from some of the more conservative Democrats in both chambers. And of course, a handful of them were bounced out by more progressive leaning candidates. The last bit is that the day our story ran, the governor included this issue on her list of legislative priorities.
From your reporting, you know, you found that a majority of these storefront lenders are in low-income areas, heavily Native and Latino. That seems to keep the cycle of this generational poverty located in specific places. Tell me, why did you all point that out in your reporting?
At least in Santa Fe County, we found on the south side, where you've got a much higher prevalence of non-white communities and a much higher prevalence of folks living in much, much lower tax brackets. And this is according to census data. It's not something we just made up. You see a huge prevalence of these stores. And if you go up to the plaza or the downtown area, you couldn't find one with a GPS locator.
He is Jeff Proctor with the Santa Fe Reporter. The article is called The Wait. He wrote that with Catherine Lewin. Jeff, thank you so much for being with me, my friend. We're going to keep an eye on this.
Thanks for having me.
KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. Well, COVID-19 continues to top the headlines in New Mexico and across the country. And this week, a very disturbing report. Workplace safety regulators are fining an auto parts store in southeastern New Mexico $243,000 amid accusations that it allowed employees with coronavirus symptoms to continue to work without properly screening them. The Environment Department announced the penalty this week against O'Reilly Auto Parts in Lovington, where employees showing symptoms were allowed to work and ultimately tested positive for the virus. Three workers tested positive, including a 46-year-old woman who later died. A company representative had no immediate comment. Infection rates and daily deaths are at least tending downward in New Mexico. Testing at the state capitol has identified some infections as lawmakers grapple with pandemic safety. Well, school districts, of course, across the state and the nation are also dealing with this. Las Cruces Public Schools will begin offering limited face-to-face learning opportunities following a vote this week by the school board. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
In a 4-1 decision, the Las Cruces Public School Board voted to expand current in-person learning efforts. While board members discussed the possibility of implementing a hybrid learning model, allowing for students in the classroom twice a week, they ultimately decided to begin with a smaller reopening approach, targeting students most in need of in-person instruction. Just who will qualify for those in-person opportunities is still being defined by the district, but Superintendent Karen Trujillo says a plan will be presented at the next school board meeting in mid-February.
We'll work with teachers on an individual basis to determine how we can increase opportunities for face-to-face learning for students.
School board member Terry Dahlman, the only member to vote against increasing in-person learning opportunities, spoke about the need to ensure educators receive the COVID vaccine before entering into any hybrid model, directing her comments at Superintendent Trujillo.
One of the comments, Dr. Trujillo, that you said was that our employees are employees of the district. And so, in other words, they have to perform when they're called upon, basically. Those weren't your words, but that's how I'm perceiving it. But they never did sign up to die. And so if they are not vaccinated, Dr. Trujillo, I can't even entertain reopening at this point.
In a survey conducted by the Las Cruces chapter of the National Education Association, 583 educators indicated they would be more comfortable returning to the classroom after receiving both doses of the COVID vaccine following inoculation. 225 responded they would be willing to return to the classroom in a hybrid model without a vaccine, while 322 did not feel ready to return to in-person learning at all this school year. Currently, 1,487 district employees have received the first dose of the COVID vaccine. NEA Las Cruces President Denise Sheehan advised the Las Cruces School Board to delay full reopening efforts until more educators have the opportunity to be vaccinated.
It is the recommendation of NEA Las Cruces that the board wait until all educators who want the vaccine receive both doses with the recommended time to reach immunity before transitioning to a full hybrid plan. This adds an additional layer of protection and assurance of a safer work environment. No one wants to return to in-person learning more than the educators who dedicate their lives to help their students succeed, but we must do it safely.
It's a sentiment shared by educators across New Mexico, evident by a statewide survey indicating that 75% of National Education Association members in the state consider COVID-19 to still pose a risk to their health and life. School board member Maria Flores says teachers willing to go back to the classroom should be utilized, but no one should force educators to return before they are vaccinated.
I don't feel comfortable opening in any way, but if teachers are willing to go back, if they feel safe going back, then they should go back and work in the small groups that are identified as needing this instruction, that are on the edge, that are not feeling well, kids that are depressed, etc. I understand that. That makes sense to me.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
The pandemic, also a topic of discussion in advance of tomorrow's Super Bowl. Many are concerned about this, including commentator Walt Rubel.
I'm not sure if the Super Bowl this Sunday is a testament to our persistence and ability to overcome challenges, or more evidence that our priorities are all screwed up. But I will admit that I'm surprised they made it to the finish. When Major League Baseball stumbled out of the gate in July, with both the Miami Marlins and the St. Louis Cardinals having to shut down in the first week, I didn't see much hope for the NFL being able to complete its season. They didn't get here without paying a cost. According to USA Today, 262 players have tested positive since the NFL began testing on August 1, 2020. As a football fan, I noticed a disturbing but predictable trend once the season started and the positive tests were announced. Broadcasters and fans started treating positive COVID-19 tests the same as an ankle injury. How long will he be out was everybody's primary concern. Buffalo Bills tight end Tommy Sweeney developed myocarditis, an inflammation of the heart that can lead to heart attacks, strokes, and death, and is found in patients who had contracted COVID-19. Even players who returned to action were dealing with impacts that we couldn't see. Former league MVP Lamar Jackson said he felt flu-like symptoms and lost his sense of smell during the 10-day quarantine after testing positive. When he returned to action, the entire left side of his body cramped up during a play against the Cleveland Browns. Browns defensive lineman Myles Garrett missed 2 games after testing positive and said when he returned to action, his breathing was labored, he had severe coughing fits, and felt as if he was being choked. Raiders tackle Trent Brown was on the COVID-19 list twice and had to be rushed to the hospital before a game in Cleveland. the long-term impacts for these players and others infected with the virus won't be known for several years. I understand there are essential workers getting sick and dying every day who do not have the same access to testing and treatment as millionaire athletes. My sympathies are with them and their loved ones. Some of them will rightly be honored at the big game. The NFL has announced that 7,500 vaccinated healthcare workers have been given free tickets to the game. All 32 teams will be able to select doctors and nurses from their community, which is terrific. But there will also be 14,500 additional fans at Raymond James Stadium. They won't necessarily be vaccinated and aren't as likely to strictly follow the health protocols. That seems like a super spreader, and it doesn't seem all that essential. Not this year. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. Well, the New Mexico State University athletic programs are once again practicing in Las Cruces, but COVID restrictions will not allow home games. So NMSU basketball will be playing at Eastwood High School in El Paso. In depth, here's KRWG intern Sarah Rodriguez.
NMSU athletics came to a halt last March due to the COVID-19 pandemic. With all sports being delayed to the spring season, Athletic Director Mario Mocha says the department has been working hard to ensure safety for practice and competition.
You know, at the time we figured, hey, we hope things would get better. It would allow our student athletes to do what we promised them to do, practice and have the ability to compete. So as we move into the spring, you know, we have a unique situation where virtually all of our sports will be playing at the same time. You know, that never happens.
NMSU athletes were originally not allowed to practice in Las Cruces due to the state of New Mexico's COVID-19 restrictions. This forced men and women's basketball to spend 9 weeks in Arizona for practice and games. The teams were able to return to New Mexico on January 20th due to amendments in the COVID restrictions.
We just recently received the okay to be able to practice in Las Cruces and compete outside of the state and not have to quarantine when we come back. Those were huge, but now, you know, we have to find venues outside of the state to compete in.
Even though the teams can't compete at home, the news of being able to return to the Pan American Center was enough for the Aggies, according to women's basketball head coach Brooke Atkinson.
I mean, we'll just take anything just to be able to sleep at home, you know, in our own beds and practice, you know, in the comforts of the Pan Am or our practice gym. Like, we were super excited. We just didn't know when it was going to happen. And it was our actual off day when we found out. And I mean, we were so excited. We couldn't get back soon enough.
Players like Aaliyah Prince were also ready to come back to Las Cruces.
Everyone was excited that we get to come back home. Like, just the idea of being away from home wasn't setting right with us, and being out of our comfort zone, that was a big thing.
There were many uncertainties and obstacles during the past few months, according to men's basketball head coach Chris Jans.
Now that we're in the midst of it, it's all came true. You know, we've had postponements and cancellations left and right. So, you know, we've had more than our fair share of that. We're hoping for better days ahead.
The Aggies are set to play their home games at Eastwood High School in El Paso. El Paso is a preferred location for the Aggies, says Jans.
You know, being 45, 50 minutes rather than 5 or 6 hours is going to be much, much more desirable for us to play our home games in our WAC schedule of the remaining season.
Aggies trail. Rice for the win. He banked it in!
With the absence of a band, fans, and the overall NMSU spirit, Jan says that the Aggies are definitely missing what makes the Pan American Center so special.
Just that feeling of a home game in the Pan Am, and knowing that we've got our sixth man behind us and we've had so much success on that floor. We definitely miss having that support and that sixth man and that feel of a college basketball home game in Las Cruces, and we definitely miss it.
The season may look different, but Atkinson says that the Aggies are making the most out of every moment given to them.
anytime that you're able to practice, you gotta get the best out of it, because you just don't know if, you know, you're going to be paused because of a COVID related issue, whether it's your own team or whether it's because you played somebody else. So I think if anything, this has just really made us focus on the moment. You can't look too far ahead. You can't even look a couple hours ahead, because you just don't really know.
The Aggies will continue to persevere through this unprecedented time. Best of luck to all teams this season. Go Aggies. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Sarah Rodriguez.
Great job, Sarah. Thanks for that. Well, the StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative came to Las Cruces last March, and every week we are featuring portions of those interviews with local veterans. Today, part two of our conversation with Army veteran Tony Martinez, who shared his story with StoryCorps' Zajilia Davis Vasquez.
You know, 2003 was already 21, 22 years into my military career. I could have left a couple years earlier. But the reality is 9/11 hit, and I felt a certain compelling desire to continue to serve. And then I got the call to go and do my part. Partly, I felt fortunate that I only had to serve 7 months out of a year, 8 months out of a year by the time all is said and done. Now we had people that were going back. And no, historically now we can look back and say, well, you know, that was an 18-year war. I mean, and we still have troops there today. And that war has never, you know, has never ended. So coming back for me was different, because, yes, I was back, but my comrades aren't back. There's still several of them that are even serving there today.
Can you talk about, or can you just reflect on what you wish civilians in general understood about military and veterans?
Yeah,
and
I mean,
time
I think I talked about an exchange I had with Ambassador Dalanovich, who was ambassador to Costa Rica, the U.S. ambassador to Costa Rica at the time. He had sent me an email saying, you know, it's, you know, going into harm's way, you know, heroes like yourself, and, you know, words to that effect. And I said, you know, it's not about me, and it's not about this. You know, I'm going to serve what the desires of our elected officials are. And in this case, it means, you know, serving out our nation's orders, our order from our president. That's not heroic. It's just, that's just a fact of life, right? And I think that a lot of people, when you come back, find that to be different. They find that to be somewhat foreign, that we will do things that maybe personally we don't agree with, you know. And I will tell you, as I sit here and now, you know, 18 years later, 17 years later, I didn't necessarily agree with that war. I didn't necessarily think we needed to go in and fight. I felt that Afghanistan was where we needed to continue our fight. And at that point, we didn't, you know, I'll go. But on the other hand, I understand why you need me to go. And I'll do it, you know, without reservations. But on the other hand, it wasn't like I was going there, you know, because I would have chose to do that. And so I think that when I come back, I mean, people start thinking that, oh, because you served, you supported that. Well, no, not necessarily. I think that people have a right, you know, to their opinions of what they think the right thing is, and their opinions. What I will tell you as I close is their opinions should be cast at the ballot box. Because if you don't like that, you know, let's listen to what the others are saying about what they would do about it. And then let's, you know, let's cast our votes accordingly. And that's what I had said back to Ambassador Dvalinovich in my letter at that point. And my reply back to him, I says, I'm serving the will of the people, and the will of the people was casted through a vote. And it's up to the people to speak up, even if it's not an election year, to speak up from, you know, from a standpoint of advocacy, to tell them that that's not the right use of our military or the right use of our tax dollars and so forth. And so from that perspective, I will say that returning back was one of the the key points that I wanted to. Costa Rica, where I returned back to, does not have a military, so they didn't really understand in the plant I was working. You know, they were just glad I was back. But on the other hand, they asked a lot of questions because they're a neutral country that doesn't have that. And there's other countries that are kind of don't understand some of the things that we do. And I submit that there's a lot of Americans who don't really understand why we're doing certain things, why we're in certain parts of the world. But we are.
Do you have any other things you want to say? I think we only have a few seconds, but...
No, I think I want to thank you for the opportunity that you've given me for me to have a voice, to have this ability to convey that for future generations. There will be many that will follow similar type of backgrounds, and hopefully I have answered some of their questions before they get into something rather than afterwards.
That's Army veteran Tony Martinez. You can hear the full interview with him and many other veterans in our StoryCorps section. You'll find it under the radio tab at krwg.org. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, now accepting admission in their 3 sanitized homes. More information at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. On the Health Watch this week, the administration of Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is backing legislation that would expand subsidies to the state's health insurance exchange for residents who do not qualify for Medicaid. The bill would substitute a state surtax on insurance premiums for a slightly smaller federal fee that expired late last year. Proceeds would be used to pay down premiums and other out-of-pocket costs for individuals and families that obtain insurance through the state's exchange. State insurance regulators hope the measure might extend insurance coverage to 23,000 people who go without coverage. Many white Americans don't recognize the higher levels of pollution in Black, Latino, and low-income neighborhoods. That's according to a poll conducted for the Environmental Defense Fund. Roz Brown has more from the Texas News Service.
When high pollution levels occur in a neighborhood, residents are likely to be Black or Latino families, and a new survey finds many white Americans are unaware of the disparity. Elise Nelson-Leary with the Environmental Defense Fund says a national poll conducted for the group found that fewer than 4 in 10 white adults know that minority neighborhoods often aren't like their own. She says pollution and contaminants are far more likely to be detected in Black, Latino, and low-income neighborhoods.
Low-income communities and communities of color have endured disproportionate harm from climate change.
Nelson-Leary says 60% of U.S. respondents to the poll who identified as Black said they were very concerned about air pollution exposure in their community versus 32% of white adult respondents. Juan Paris with Texas Environmental Justice Advocacy Services says unless you live in a neighborhood with high levels of pollution, you're unlikely to know the difference. He adds that people often lack understanding, even if they recognize the privileges afforded by culture and circumstances.
And then some that do, they don't blame it on the environment. They blame it on the people themselves, thinking, well, why don't they move out? Why don't they move out to a better community? It's all a matter of, I think, education and understanding.
According to Nelson-Leary, the poll found that 51% of Black respondents and 48% of Latino respondents believe environmental injustice is a major problem in the U.S., while only 33% of white adult respondents agree.
We wanted to use this poll to get a pulse of how people were seeing these issues. And so this poll really, again, was to collect that data and to really understand how we can better talk about environmental justice.
The survey also shows that concern about climate change and its impact on the economy is more prevalent among Black and Latino respondents than white respondents. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Also on the Health Watch this week, almost a year into the pandemic, some new mothers have experienced pregnancy, labor, and delivering a newborn, all under very difficult circumstances. Texas Tech Public Media's Sarah Self-Walbrick reports.
Say hi. Say, I don't want nothing but this bottle.
Victoria Stevens feeds her 3-month-old baby, Nathan. He sits on his mom's lap and stares at the phone screen with his big brown eyes. He's content.
What's wrong?
at least for a few minutes.
He is an intention hogger. We're learning how to be independent so mom can get schoolwork.
Victoria is a college student and a first-time mom. She found out she was pregnant early last year, around the same time the coronavirus was first confirmed in Lubbock in March.
It was a really hard emotional thing for me.
It was 9 months of anxiety. Victoria was isolated and felt lonely, but she says that distancing from the world brought her closer to her partner.
Having to sit down and have real conversations about how we were going to raise our son because, like, we literally had nothing else to do.
Still, there were some disappointments.
I always imagine having a big baby shower with all my family and the decorations and the pictures. Everything just kept not happening.
And then the day the young family waited for arrived. Victoria says her labor experience was different, but smooth. The real challenge started back home.
I just want to, like, go outside and not worry about my son getting sick.
Her boyfriend works 12-hour shifts. Victoria spends her time in their one-bedroom apartment. But even with her baby there, it can get lonely.
Especially when he can't talk, because he's just now learning how to make noises and stuff, so he'd just be quiet.
Victoria is not alone in her anxiety as a new mom navigating a pandemic.
A delivery is a lot more difficult to plan for than, you know, your dream wedding. There's a lot more unknowns and complications that can come up.
Dr. Bennett Henderson is an obstetrician and gynecologist with Covenant Health. She says nerves have kicked in early for expectant moms, but she's seen a silver lining for some patients.
Moms a lot of time feel a lot of obligation to share that time with everybody, and they don't always want to. So it's been a way to kind of weed out having to host people in a really important, vulnerable time.
We didn't go anywhere with a newborn anyways the first time.
It's been a long 10 months for everyone, for new moms and for those who know the parenting game.
But at least this time there's a better excuse to not see people.
Breon Luna had her second child in August, a little girl named Lainey.
The first time was more scary of the unknown of having a kid. The second time was more scary of the unknown of just what's happening in the world.
Breon is a nurse. She avoided working with COVID patients through her pregnancy, but still worried about catching the virus. She had many questions, especially when the coronavirus first hit.
How would my baby be? How would I handle it? And then, of course, like, if I'm having to deliver and I'm positive, like, am I going to be alone? Is my baby going to be taken away?
Those questions continued after her daughter arrived. She wonders when her kids will see unmasked faces in crowds. As a nurse, Breon was part of the first group eligible for the new vaccine and got the shot. That's eased at least some new mom anxiety. I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick in Lubbock.
That's KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. So good to be with you every Saturday night. Of course, if you ever miss the program on the radio, it is on demand in the local radio section at krwg.org. Send us your story ideas and comments. The email address is feedback@nmsu.edu. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.